For program information, audio, video and more, head to the RN homepage.
And good morning, welcome to Life Matters. Now on ABC RN for the next hour of your morning. How are you today? Great to have your company. Natasha Mitchell joining you. Oh, I'm going to ask this. If you had to pick from all the cultures of the world, who would be your perfect match? Culturally, but intimately as well. The Latino lover, the Italian charmer, the earnest German. I like earnest Germans. In fact, they're my favourite. Are these stereotypes real, though? Coming up, an anthropological travel odyssey with a difference. Bambi Smythe is taking us on it. A fairly wild itinerary. What a gamble. From a Vatican priest to a Russian multimillionaire. 75 men, 75 dates. Yeah, pooey to internet dating. So stay with us for that and much more. Peter Martin is joining us for Everyday Economics on penalty rates this morning. You can tweet us at RN Life Matters. Love to hear from you. Last weekend, I drove past a new high-rise apartment development in progress, and it was rising up adjacent to a very, very busy and pretty filthy highway, chock full of speeding cars across the road. There was a waterway, although the last time I looked at that waterway, there was a television floating upright in it. And yet, on this development was a big sign, spruiking water views. And we're told, of course, aren't we, that higher density living is the way to go if our cities are to be more sustainable. Perhaps you live in an apartment or you have downsized to one and you love it. The Festival of Urbanism kicks off today over at the University of Sydney. And one of the events tomorrow night is a discussion, health and high rise. Is density bad for you? Joining me are two of the speakers. One's an urban planner, Dr. Jennifer Kent, is a lecturer in the Department of Environment and Geography at Macquarie University. Her research really focuses on that intersection between planning and health, which is what we want to talk about this morning. And the other is a public health expert, Associate Professor Stephen Corbett. He's the Director of the Centre for Population Health in the Western Sydney Local Health District. Welcome to you both.
Good morning.
Good to have you here. And Jennifer, is density bad for you? And I guess, you know, in a country that's been dominated by the quarter-acre block, we might intuitively say, well, yes, it is. What do we mean by density?
Oh, usually in an urban planning perspective, it's measured as the number of dwellings or the number of people that we have per hectare. I would argue, though, that we need to start looking at density in a more holistic way. So it's not just about the number of dwellings, but it's about the services that those people have access to, the infrastructure that's around those areas, the access to employment and things like that.
Mm. So it doesn't sound like a battery hen kind of density packing sort of figure.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's not just about people per hectare, it's about a whole lot more.
Yeah, it's about a whole package. Mm. Yep.
What are the trends in terms of density in Australia? Are we getting more or less dense?
We are getting more dense in Australia. It's been an urban planning policy for, I guess, about the last 30 years or so in a lot of major cities around Australia, including Sydney. And as a result of that, we are finding increased consolidation in a lot of our cities, including Sydney.
This is even with urban expansion as well?
Even with urban expansion, the population in our cities is growing, and that's we're accommodating it in different ways, and density is one way that we're doing it.
We'll just touch on this, but we'll come back to more. You're interested as much in the negative aspects of density as you are in the positive aspects of density. So let's just tease out a couple of those before I come to you, Stephen. Physical activity. And we've been talking about this a lot on Life Matters in the last month.
Yep. There's a number of ways that higher density living can facilitate more physical activity. A lot of it is about critical mass. And by that, I mean that in many of the built environments, outcomes that are required to encourage people to be more physically active, they require a lot of people to make them work. So active transport is a perfect example. And this is one that public health people are always really keen to encourage, because if we can tie physical activity to another sort of activity, like the need to get from A to B, people are more likely to do it. And higher density environments encourage active transport in a number of ways. Firstly, it's the critical mass, the bike paths, the separated walkways, and also public transport networks require a lot of people to make them work.
We don't always get that right, though, even in urban high density environments, though, do we? That opportunity to maximise active transport.
No, it's extraordinarily difficult and extraordinarily complex.
So what about diet? Because you've got an interesting take on this too. This is all about what food is available to us when we live in a high density environment. And sometimes it's just packaged supermarket food from the local, you know, shop.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of access to healthy food, what we're trying to do from an urban planning perspective is bring sort of healthy fresh produce into the centre of our suburbs rather than keeping it sort of on the far-flung outskirts. And again, that requires people to make that work. The small scale grocery stores that have fresh produce, they require people to make them economically viable. Also, things like farmers markets and community gardens, they thrive in areas where there's a lot of people out and about. Another interesting aspect of this is the more land that we take up for residential uses on the peri-urban fringe, the less likelihood is that that land can be used for the growing of fresh produce. Mm. So we're sort of separating ourselves from the source of where our fresh food is grown by increasingly sprawling on the outskirts of our cities.
But another aspect of high-density environments is if you think of those developments that have, you know, tiny kitchens, tiny entertainment spaces. I mean, in some radical cases, no kitchen at all.
Yep.
And people are out and about eating takeaway all the time, and that's no recipe necessarily for a good diet.
No, I think, the Building Code of Australia would prevent provision of an apartment building without a kitchen here. So we definitely do have kitchens in our apartment buildings. But again, it's about that exposure to fresh produce. It's about having it in our suburbs so that people can have that option if they need it.
Yes, a challenge. Stephen Corbett, you, as a public health professional, you're concerned about the unintended consequences of high-density planning. Let's tease out some of those concerns of unintended consequences.
Well, yes, Jennifer has outlined some of the benefits to public health of increased density, and I work in Western Sydney. It's a car-dependent community. People are spending a long time sitting, driving in cars, exposed to air pollution. So I would endorse the move to densify in the sense that it will obviate some of those health problems. Mm. But urban planning is very complex and there are unintended consequences. It's a strife of interests and one of but there is an ancient and not always inviolable principle which bind public health and urban planning together, and that is don't place people next to hazards. It's why tanneries and slaughterhouses were put on the fringes of medieval London or ancient Rome. It is a principle, but one of the perverse outcomes, I think, of increasing density in Sydney that is observable around town is the sprouting of high-rise developments along major transport corridors.
And that was exactly what I witnessed where I am, this high-rise springing up out of a really busy road. So have we forgotten that roads are hazards?
No. Well, look, there's good evidence. There's good evidence from crowded countries like the Netherlands and Hong Kong, that people who live next to major roadways have higher rates of asthma. The children have higher rates of asthma, chronic respiratory disease, cardiovascular disease. It's a combined effect, probably, of air pollution and noise, because noise has a range of adverse health effects as well.
Noise isn't going to cause asthma.
No, that's true. No, but there's a range of health effects of each, and noise to some extent is easier to engineer away. But the concern about air quality, I think, remains, and I guess that the trick is to try and give it to give that problem weight when new developments are being assessed. And for health, that's sometimes the issue because there's a policy cacophony. There's a whole range of interests that need to be considered.
Is there good evidence in Australia, though, is someone doing this work, that the way in which our roads are being built adjacent to high-density housing developments is a problem for our health?
Look, as far as I'm aware, there's not a lot of research that has gone into looking at the health impacts of roadside pollution. Some of the best work comes from, as I said, the Netherlands and Hong Kong. But research can be transferred very easily. I mean, really, it's a product of the number of cars or trucks per hour that are passing somebody's house, how far their house is away from that source of pollution. And results of overseas research are easily transferable here. There's no reason to believe that would be any different here because the geometry and the mathematics of exposure are similar.
So what can we do differently? Rather than that example that I cited at the top of the apartment block rising up out of the dust next to a major highway.
Well, interesting. We can do something, and the solution is simple. This is not rocket science.
No. We've done it with freeways, haven't we? With
those National Heart Foundation have recently reviewed this issue, and some of the problems with urban density and health is there's an interim guidance by the New South Wales Department of Planning dating back to 2008, and really it's creating some distance between the development and the road, setbacks, and some of these hazards attenuate very rapidly with distance, and so setbacks of variable distance, 10, 20, perhaps a block even, will obviate many of these hazards. So, but that's sometimes expensive and sometimes difficult because of zoning and other issues. But I think that's an important element here is setbacks because that will to some extent address the hazard.
To what extent, and I'll get a comment from both of you on this, do you see planners in Australia taking into account health concerns? Jennifer?
It's something that we've been doing a lot of work on. I, until recently, was part of something called the Healthy Built Environments Program, which was based in the Faculty of the Built Environment at UNSW and funded by New South Wales Health. And one of our roles was to try and educate planners on the need to take health into account. And we actually had quite a lot of success with that. The recent review of the New South Wales planning legislation, the draft bill, which is currently still under consideration, we got health as a consideration for development assessment in that draft bill, and that was a massive achievement.
What sort of aspects of health? The things that we've been discussing today?
The things that we've been discussing today, amenity, safety, things like that. So if that bill were to pass, it would mean that for any development assessment that happened, health would need to be a consideration in that development assessment. So it is an increasingly important issue in planning and increasingly recognised as such in the planning fraternity. I think the problem is that planning is a really busy discipline. Planners are busy people and we have a lot of things that we need to take into account. Even though human health might seem like it's the thing that we should be placing as number one, we can never forget that we're operating in economic and political environments. So it doesn't always come as the forefront, even though we're aware of it.
And people want to make a buck out of big developments, so they stack them high and stack them closely. Yep. Stephen Corbett, how do you see the relationship between planning and public health in Australia? Don't hold back if you've got strong views, sir.
No. Well, I do have strong views, and I think that Jennifer has mentioned some of the initiatives that have happened in New South Wales, and as a director of a public health unit in Western Sydney, we do get to comment and assess developments in terms of their health hazards. What we don't have control over is the weight that health advice or information is given in the judgment, because it's very complicated. Now, let me give you an example. A multi-storey building on a roadway might be an opportunity to offer low-cost housing to people, for example. And if you've got a mortgage that's $100,000 or $200,000, $1,000 less than you otherwise would have. That might have health benefits as well. How do you weigh up these the exposure to air pollution to not being stressed because you've got to pay a high mortgage? I mean, these are complex
problems. Or be subject to the vagaries of the rental market.
That's right. These are complex problems. One of the reasons I have some optimism about this is I think it's possible to observe a move towards strategic assessment of planning initiatives, because typically in health we're asked to comment upon a development or a proposal. What are the health impacts of this proposal? But it doesn't tell you about what's going to happen next year next door, or what a canyon along Parramatta Road might be like for the people who live there rather than just one or two a high-rise development. So looking at the long term, looking at cumulative effects, these are things that need to be done to configure our city optimally for the health of its residents.
And I think, Jennifer, you, in order for us to reap the benefits of high-density living, you think that we have to change the way we think about our built environment quite fundamentally.
Yeah, I think we do. I mean, for density to work in Sydney, for density to
but
have...
But we're going national, yeah. And so this is applicable to all cities undergoing rapid growth in their centres across Australia.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose for density to work in any Australian city, people are going to have to do things differently. People are going to have to work differently, to travel differently, to socialise differently and to raise their families differently and even source their food differently. And, I mean, one of the key things that I think we don't often acknowledge as planners is that the people who are living in our cities are going to have to get used to living with more people around, and not everybody is happy with that.
They're not, are they, Stephen Corbett?
No.
It's a head shift.
That's right. And there's a lot of people who obviously prefer to have their quarter acre block or whatever it is. And I guess the market, to some extent, will sort out that diversity in the community. If you build apartments that don't sell, well, they'll stop being built. But it's what do governments need to do to shape the city optimally?
Can we do anything as consumers if we want to make a shift from a house to an apartment? What can we look for,
Jennifer? You might be there.
It's really interesting because the Heart Foundation, who Stephen mentioned before, have been really active in this area. And they did a consumer study a few years ago where they did a phone poll of about, I think it was 1,500 people, asking them about what they prefer about their neighbourhood. And a lot of the things that people preferred were walkable distance to shops and services, good access to public transport. There were things that you do see in higher density neighbourhoods. So I think if, as consumers, we can consistently promote that message that it's not that we don't only want the high density, we don't only want the high-rise buildings, we want all the infrastructure and the services and the amenity that can come with that.
Very briefly.
Yeah. The early introduction of schools has been one thing which binds a community together early.
Yep.
And that, for example, is one planning initiative which might be useful.
Yes, I'd be fascinated to probe more the comment you made, Jennifer, about we need to think about our families differently, we need to think about our work differently. Let's talk about that again on the program. Thank you so much for joining us. Have a great festival of urbanism this week.
Thank you.
Dr Jennifer Kent, lecturer in the Department of Environment and Geography at Macquarie University, Associate Professor Stephen Corbett, Director of the Centre for Population Health in the Western Sydney Local Health District. They'll be speaking on the topic of health and high density living at the University of Sydney tomorrow, and details of the festival on the Life Matters website. It is just festivalofurbanism.com if you want to get there right now and check it out. And on Life Matters, Natasha Mitchell with you this morning. Penalty rates in everyday economics up next. Are they an endangered species?
Hello, this is Andrew Ford. This Saturday's music show is at the Melbourne Festival. We'll meet a string quartet that's playing in a circus, the ancient Chinese instrument, the guqin, film composer Clint Mansell, and the jazz and blues of New Orleans. There'll be lots of chat and live music, and if you're in Melbourne, we'd love you to join us. We'll be at the Festival Hub by Prince's Bridge. If not, stay at home and tune in to RN, Saturday morning after the 10 o'clock news.
Well, hands up if you work 9 to 5. Now, keep them up if you work on weekends. Raise them a little bit higher if you can't even tell when you work anymore. If you are one of the growing band of always on, ever connected workers, I imagine you probably have little sympathy for those who get paid extra for Sundays, even more for public holidays and special loadings for working at night, those unsocial hours. Is the tide turning against penalty rates, though? Since we last discussed extra pay for unsocial hours earlier in the year, well, the Fair Pay Commission has cut some penalty rates in the retail sector and is set to cut more, apparently. Do penalty rates still have a place in our modern 24/7 world? Or could it be that the way many of us work now makes these things even more important? Our everyday economist, Peter Martin, of course, economics editor of The Age, joins us as he does every second Wednesday. Good morning.
G'day, Natasha.
Penalty rates. Who manages to get penalty rates in the Australian workforce at the moment?
I think there's a bit of a class distinction, actually. I don't. Now, I used to, and people, information workers used to, okay? So I used to get paid extra for, you know, if I worked early or late, and I used to get paid extra for Sundays. Those days are long gone. I'm, like you said, I'm paid for being on. And my employer's incredibly generous, Natasha. They give me a laptop, very kind of them. They give me a mobile phone, extraordinarily generous. All they expect in return is that I'm always available. And indeed, if you're an information worker, it's rather hard to tell when you're working and when you're not. I mean, regardless of technology, you're always thinking. And I think we have this class of people, this, I suppose, new class, if you like, or the always-on thing is new. And then we have the people who serve in restaurants. We have the people who work in shops. We have nurses, we have emergency workers, people who have to work at night.
Police.
Yes, they get penalty rates. They are, if you like, in this, what those people in this future age would think of as anachronistic. They're paid time and a half for Saturdays, double time for Sundays, an extra 25%.
And a lot of those workers, though, are working shifts that change from week to week.
Oh, that's even worse.
So in some sense, penalty rates are about acknowledging that. But traditionally, what have penalty rates been about? What do they represent?
They represent a penalty for the employer. They go back to 1917, so they have a long history in Australia and overseas. There's nothing particularly unusual about Australia in this. The idea was that socialisation, being with other people, is important, and the times to do that are at night. If you're with your loved one, your family, you like to go to sleep the same time as they do, on the weekends, especially Sunday. Sunday has been sacrosanct in every country, certainly every Western country in the world. That's the idea.
And there was a landmark Industrial Relations Commission ruling around that.
Yeah, and this is very recently. This was 1998. And the ruling said that notwithstanding all of these changes, the norm remains for evenings, weekends and public holidays to be the time when friends and families, social groupings, whoever constructed, are able to get together. Now, although that was recently, this year the Industrial Commission has, it's called the Fair Work Commission now, has moved against them in the retail industry. Now they've cut the Sunday penalty for casual workers, and they're looking at cutting it more.
So there's still a penalty?
Oh, yeah, it's still there.
But they've cut it back?
Yeah, they've cut it from 50 to 25% for Saturdays.
What was the rationale for that?
The rationale was actually that casual workers, they only cut it for casual workers that they're having two bites of the cherry. They get an extra 25% in retail for working casual, and then they get extra for working on weekends. But also in that was a recognition that we're not doing what we were on the weekends. Now, weekends, I don't know what your parents did or what my parents did on the weekends, but looking at the time use survey, heard of the ABS time use survey where the Bureau asks people to fill out diaries. Well, if you go back to the 1990s even, I looked it up, we socialised for 3 hours every weekend. Guess what we do now?
Less or more?
Well, guess.
Less.
1 hour every weekend. Now, we're looking at screens, we're shopping, we're doing twice the shopping we did. But socialising, you know, you've got this segment on Life Matters called When Did This Become a Thing?
Yeah.
Well, socialising is becoming much less of a thing, okay?
Well, we're socialising in different ways and we still need time to do it.
Yeah, we're socialising on our screens, in fact.
That's right, but that still takes time. That's still socialising.
That's true, although I don't want to dob myself or anyone else in here, but a lot of people do that at work, I suppose. So the idea of the weekend being a place where people would go round to each other's houses, do things like that, has gone. And into this situation, the Chamber of Commerce and Industry, the Business Council, all of these people are saying, ha-ha, the world's changed. Sundays are no longer special or no longer as special as they were. There's no longer as great a penalty, as great a punishment for someone who has to work Sunday. I mean, what would they be doing anyway? These days, the figures show they're probably shopping.
So they've been clawed back in the case of retail workers, according to the Fair Work Commission. Yeah. How substantial are penalty rates across the different sectors?
Very. In Australia, we have fairly big ones. You can get double time for Sundays. Depends whether you're retail or hospitality. 25% for working outside of ordinary hours. It's what I once used to get when I worked on AM. Those days, I think it was 15% then.
How things have changed.
yeah, indeed. 50% is usually typical for working on a Saturday. And for public holidays, which are regarded as the most sacrosanct times, they're enormous. They can be, in retail, 2.5 times you get, which is why a lot of shops are closed on public holidays.
Well, and on that basis, businesses say that penalties is at an enormous amount to their wages bill expenses. Some say it makes their businesses unsustainable.
Yeah, I don't think this is so, and I think we can dispense with that almost straight away by...
But you're talking about big penalty rates there, so that's a legitimate argument, surely, on behalf of business.
But they're not... Well, they're big penalty rates. The ones that remain are for low-paid workers, so you have to ask the question, what would they be getting if penalty rates went? I mean, the basic wage for someone who works in a restaurant is, I think, $17 an hour. Now, penalties add a lot to that. Is it really believable that if penalties went, there wouldn't be pressure for those to rise, or indeed in the case of nurses, employers would have to pay them penalties anyway just to get them to work at night? I mean, if you had a choice, what would you do? What would most people do? So I've gone through the figures for the hospitality industry. I'll put a link on the website. I did this for the Age newspaper. And they don't seem to be onerous. You can work that out just because, notwithstanding all of the complaints, the amount spent in restaurants has been booming. Amount of people employed in the industry has been booming. Yes, 15% of restaurants close every year. Yes, another 15% open. Yes, the industry is doing all right. I think the argument against... So I can understand what what business is saying, that the world has moved on. I don't have much sympathy for the arguments. They can't afford them. They've managed to afford them.
Well, it's not just businesses that are saying that. This Fair Work Commission ruling is suggesting that too, which signals something very significant there.
I think, and I'm not alone in thinking this, there's a new study which I'll also link to from the University of South Australia, that there's an argument that penalties, or rather that weekends, coordinated leisure, is the new buzz phrase, matter more than ever.
Mm.
More than ever. This is why. You now have two income couples. So it used to be that if the bloke was forced to work on Sunday and got Tuesday off, it wasn't so bad. at least the bloke would see the blokess, okay, right? It's a bloke, the blokess was at home, okay, so wouldn't be a problem. These days, two income couples, the idea, the difficulty of finding coordinated leisure is intense. Now, we have, if you like, the penalties exist, as I said, they exist often for low-paid workers, that they don't exist for information workers much, but the fact that they're there puts a taboo on, if you like, it holds the dam back. Now, my employer makes me work Sunday from time to time. It doesn't pay me any extra for it. That's fine. But there's at least an understanding that it's the kind of thing which should be infrequent or should be avoided where possible. If that goes, my ability to meet, and if it goes in the case of my wife, our ability to actually be together at the same time, or if you've got children, to be together with children at the same time, schools tend to work Monday to Friday, okay, to actually be together when the children need you, when they're not at school, is at risk.
Well, that's the trick. Children don't do shift work at school. So, you know, they've got a very fixed schedule that you've got to build your life around.
Yeah, exactly. Now, lots of parents do it. You know, we have this thing now in the school holidays. School holidays are, what is it, 12 weeks a year? Well, everyone, most people only get four weeks holiday a year. So parents sort of stagger things and already don't coordinate their holidays. Sundays are important for that reason. Public holidays are probably, and this is the view if you look at other countries, sacrosanct. Now, the US is the only other country which, it's the only country, only Western country, which doesn't have penalty rates. Some sort of arrangement is in the countries we compare ourselves with, Canada, New Zealand, the UK. And the belief is that there should be one day. Usually it's Sunday. Often they say, some countries say 11 p.m. Saturday night to 11 p.m. Sunday night should be sacrosanct. There's this belief that it matters. I think it still matters. I can understand that we don't do what we did on Sundays anymore.
Well, with the pullback in terms of retail penalty rates, what does that signal for other sectors, do you think?
I think it signals that those for hospitality are at risk. The situation with hospitality, and this is what the employers say, lots of those people are students. So they want to work at night, okay? They're not going to work in... It actually suits casual workers, and they're saying they shouldn't have to pay a penalty for that. I think that people such as myself, who, if you like, use restaurants, use shops after hours, run a risk if we buy into this line that penalty rates should go. The risk is that the taboo will drop and we will be in trouble, and we'll find coordinated leisure with our better half a bit more difficult.
I'll be very interested to hear from listeners on this from all perspectives, those students who are doing those evening shifts, those nurses as well, but also businesses who are you know, running a restaurant, small businesses. What's your take on penalty rates and that Fair Work Commission ruling? Very interested to hear. Peter Martin, thank you so much for joining us on Life Matters.
Pleasure.
And Natasha Mitchell here with you on ABC RN on Life Matters. Penalty rates on the menu now, men on the menu next.
On Encounter, Australian Muslim communities are feeling the pressure.
When people are practising Islam, people will choose what they want to practise and what they want to leave. I mean, we can't force everyone to practice a religion the way it should be.
But extremism is being challenged from within those communities.
We are people cloaked in the garments of piety committing the vilest of acts. My advice to them is pity. God wants our spiritual fruit and not religious nuts.
That's Encounter, Saturday at 5.
How do you recover from a broken relationship? It's a different process for every person, certainly, but perhaps after you've hauled yourself out from under the doona, you might be game and try a blind date. Or in my next guest's case, 75 blind dates. All around the world, Bambi Smythe decided to combine her three favourite passions, food, travel,
and the opposite sex. Took her to 22 countries sampling a cornucopia of cuisine and culture. But here's the thing, she was matching dates and dinners. This is a travel memoir. It's a kind of anthropological exercise as well. It's provocatively called Men on the Menu, and she joins us in our Melbourne studio now. Good morning, Bambi.
Good morning, Natasha.
I mean, anthropological quest, sort of. What was the real reason that you were doing this?
Initially, it was certainly to go out and find a bloke. I'd just broken up after an eight-year relationship and was feeling a bit sorry for myself. And I wasn't having much luck in Australia, so I thought, well, let's head off to Europe where I quite like the men. And then it evolved into something much, much bigger than that. And I just decided to, you know, as you said, combine all those passions and make it a bit more of a, you know, a cultural expose.
And a writing project as well. But so the premise... Just explain the premise here. This is about testing those romantic stereotypes.
Yes, I wanted to go to a number of countries, actually the A to Z, so Australia, Brazil, Cuba, Denmark, etc., and get an idea right around the world of were there such things as cultural stereotypes or romantic stereotypes, like with the Italian stallions, was that just a myth? And not that I was going to test it to the nth degree, but I just wanted to find out, you know, what made men from all these different countries tick. And then when you mentioned the food, I thought, while I did it, I'd like to try all the local food and then match the men's personalities with the food. So Stefano in Italy was a doppio espresso. We love Stefano. And he was a doppio espresso because to me, he was hot, rich, intense, full of flavour and gave me heart palpitations.
And he wouldn't disagree with that.
No, he enjoys the attention, I think, yes.
I mean, but here's the thing, you know, relationship breakup, I can't imagine going on a single blind date in Australia. Maybe I'm a bit gutless that way. You were up for 75 of them. Oh, that takes some guts. What is it about you that allowed you to do that?
Well, when I set out, I certainly wasn't expecting 75. That just sort of happened. I wanted to date one man in each country just to get this, you know, cultural side of it. And then my friends started introducing me to people and they'd introduce me to someone else. And so by the time I left Australia, I had 30 dates set up. And then... once I was over there, I just bumped into people. You know, I went to Portugal, I didn't know anyone, and then the prince I'd met in Naples suddenly said, well, you know, there's a famous film director you have to meet. So it just sort of went from there.
Okay, 81 days, 22 countries, 75 dates, yes, with 75 men. And I mean, just lining up the dates, yes, through friends, but some of those initial attempts got a little bit weird, didn't they? There was the bondage site in Liechtenstein. Was it Liechtenstein?
Liechtenstein. My very first foray into trying to find if this whole thing was feasible. I didn't know anyone in Liechtenstein. I don't think anyone knows anyone in Liechtenstein, really. There's only about 100 people that live there. And so I went to the tourist bureau. I thought that would be a good start.
Hello, and I'm an Australian writer and I'd like a date.
That's essentially what I said. And they very kindly wrote back with a website that, you know, might help me. And I was at work when I opened it and I clicked onto it and it's a bondage site. And it's got people in black and red rubber and body panels cut out in really embarrassing spots. And
might be your thing?
Well, it was not mine. And I thought, no, I think they've misunderstood me. And to make it worse, my boss was standing behind me at this point. So that was very, very uncomfortable. And then another one in Japan, I went onto a Japanese dating site. And because I specifically asked for a male aged 21 to 61, they said I was being racist or something. That was very odd.
Okay, so you start the journey with a date with a surfer and a farmer in Australia, but you hot foot it then to Brazil.
Yes.
And you meet Paulo the professor. Awkward would be the word I would use.
Awkward was Paulo had these great muscles. He was, you know, kept flexing them all through dinner, which was slightly disconcerting. And he'd he'd asked me expressly who was going to pay for dinner, and I said I would. But when I put the food, the money out for this very expensive meal, then he leant across and took the extra tip out of my purse.
He was quite unimpressed with you, I think.
Well, and then once I'd paid for dinner, he started trying to seduce me by singing and asking me where we were going to spend the night.
But, you know, you had to expect that this was going to be the case.
Oh, yes, yes. And I think I handled it pretty well. And I sort of got used to it in the end. You know, if people were interested, you know, I would have considered it. But I let's just say when you're faced with a smorgasbord, you put aside the limp lettuce and the soggy fries and just go for the caviar.
Oh, dear. He was a bit dull, to say the least. You know, there wasn't a lot of attraction there for you, and I can understand why as I was reading. I was thinking, not very relaxed, not very hot-blooded Latino man.
No, quite the opposite, yes.
Monaco was a bit confronting.
Monaco, I had been given an opportunity possibly to meet Prince Albert, and I was introduced to his... best friend, actually, his minder, who took it upon himself to come and meet me to see if I was appropriate to meet Albert. Mm. And unfortunately, he took one look at me and decided that I was not a supermodel, so therefore it was not going to happen.
Oh.
So I tried to salvage the situation and I went out on a date with this fellow instead who was an American, so he didn't really fit the bill. But he basically said I was a hooker for going over to Monaco and trying to meet rich men. So he had no sense of humour either. He just didn't get it.
A little bit of misinterpretation going on there.
Yes.
And Cuba you chose as much for the cultural experience as anything else. What surprised you about Cuba?
Oh, wow, Cuba's amazing.
Isn't it? Everyone says that to me, that who's been.
It's really lost in a time warp, and it's quite... Well, when I got there, it was physically very impoverished, but I discovered it was very rich in culture and vitality, and the people make the best of what they've got.
And the music.
Oh, the music. I see, I'm not really much into music, but this, it just comes from every wall, you know, every crack in the wall. It comes up through the footpath. There's this amazing music everywhere, and I think they do that to lift their spirits, and it really is an extraordinary place. And the date I had there was a lovely tour guide. He was in a wheelchair, and, you know, he expressed his sort of dissatisfaction with the, you know, living in that sort of regime. But I found the people really inspiring and really making the most. They've got hardly anything there, seriously. He couldn't even get a spare wheel or a puncture kit for his wheelchair. You know, so I was very inspired there.
It was his wife that recommended him to you. So these were the dynamics that you discovered along the way. Some unlikely conversations, and this is morning radio, so there's kind of a limit to what we can talk about. But, you know, I will admit on air that I've got a thing for German men.
Oh, yes, I know where you're going with this.
And, you know, they are disarmingly honest. People think they're earnest. They are disarmingly honest. And such was the case with 27-year-old German Jen.
Jen's was hot, hot, hot. I had a conversation with him that was, I've never had a conversation with anyone like that before, basically talking all about, you know, his experiences with sex and, well, it was a very revealing conversation. And, you know, I felt delighted that a young man of 27 was talking to someone 20 years older than him and was just sort of laying it all on the line. I found it really interesting. And as you're right, the Germans actually are very open. I think to them, sex and all of that stuff is just, you know, like breathing.
Yeah, I think you're probably right there. Mabby Smythe is my guest this morning. Men on the Menu is the title of her book. The premise was, off the back of a breakup of a relationship in her late 40s, she decided to travel the world and date men in different countries to see if they matched up to their cultural stereotypes. An interesting premise. And so then there was Olivier in France.
Lovely.
He'd studied in the same year as Oliver Stone and Martin Scorsese. He lives on a boat on the Seine. I mean, you wear your Black Widow spider outfit. He took his cultural obligation seriously, didn't he?
Olivier was one of the most charming, elegant men I've ever met. He was descended from a line of aristocrats way back when everyone else was getting their heads chopped off. And his family managed to survive, but without any of their chateaus or anything. But he was a very sophisticated, lovely man. He lived on a barge boat on the Seine under the shadow of the Eiffel Tower.
Seine. I said Seine, didn't I?
Seine.
I'm full of shocking mispronunciations today.
And Olivier was just delightful. And he was a little bit naughty, and he did take his cultural obligations seriously. He did teach me how to French kiss properly, which I was rather pleased about. And he was lovely. He was a very stereotypical, I think, Frenchman. Very, very charming and very elegant.
Mm. But Stefano in Italy.
Oh, my God.
Made your French man and your Germans look like first graders in the School of Charm, as you describe it. Personally, I find that all too much.
I hate to be predictable, Natasha. I really do. I wanted, I would have preferred to find someone fabulous in Portugal or Wales or something. But there's something about the Italians. They are so charming, and they actually really love women. They love the whole flirting game. To them, it's a game, but it's not malicious or there's no ulterior motives. They just love to flirt, and they make a woman feel great. And Stefano, I had essentially a 16-hour date with him from lunch to 4 o'clock in the morning, with just a little gap in between for me to sort of catch my breath. And he was just, I think it was because he was Italian, but also it was just the sort of man he was, highly intelligent but very warm with his intelligence, cheeky, humorous, just a really interesting man. He was my doppio espresso.
Yes, so part of the premise here is matching men to meals. And also you had a particular dating strategy, because you've got to have some opening questions, or at least some questions,
yes,
that can lubricate the conversation, so to speak. And so one of your questions is, what animal do they see themselves as being?
Well, this was a very interesting way to get people to admit, if I've only got 2 hours with them or less, asking them what animal they think their personality would match is interesting, because they'd reveal things about themselves they wouldn't ordinarily. But the funny thing was, when I asked this question, 20 of the men said they were lions. So, which was hysterical, because I think they wanted to impress me at this point. Here I am scribbling notes, so of course they're going to say a lion and not a meerkat or something. But I quite liked it when
hyena.
A hyena or a snake in the grass.
What are you?
I think I'm a dolphin. I think I'm playful, sociable. I like my freedom. I like being by the water. I hope I'm a little bit intelligent. And playful, I think. I think that's me. And only one man asked that question, and I think that said a lot about him too.
Who was the man that asked that question?
I can't remember.
There you go.
No. It was a lovely man in Budapest, in Hungary. Yes.
Stefano said, I'm a fish because I'm free to explore new depths and places that have never been discovered before.
Isn't he naughty?
There's a pickup line.
He had pickup lines. And he also
pouring out of him.
He also told me that there were 24 senses. Now, I thought there were only 6 senses, smell and taste and all of these other things. And when he told me there were 24, I thought, I'm in trouble here. So he had the pickup lines or the patted down pat, and it was thrilling just to find out how he thought, because it's not like most people think.
He certainly lingered for you. You also, in Rome, you had 2 quite contrasting experiences, and there you are in the Vatican City. How did you manage to get a date with a young priest?
Well, I had no idea when I walked in how I was going to get a priest, because I thought, because this was my V country, so I figured a priest, even though they're not born there, but I needed a priest. And I thought about trapping one in a confessional at one point and asking him all these questions.
And by the way, do you want a date?
Yes. But I was looked at very sternly by one of the guards there, who said I had to be Catholic. So I just wandered around for a while, and then I spotted this lovely young priest, or a seminarian he turned out to be, lovely looking fellow, taking a group of German tourists around. And I just went, I joined the tour group, and he looked at me in a bit of surprise, as did the Germans, and I followed him around. He was just lovely, and then I tapped him on the shoulder and asked if I could have half an hour of his time. And he was a really interesting character, and I was asking him questions about, you know, very personal questions, but, you know, what's it like to be celibate and all of those sort of things. And he was a lovely soul. I've sent him the book, and I hope he'll really be thrilled with it.
Mm. And so you also went to the United Arab Emirates. And
yes.
One of the nephew of a prominent politician, first name not mentioned, he brings along his mother's covering.
Yes, he brought along his, because I asked my friend, the person that organised it, if this fellow could wear his national costume, the dishdasher, because I wanted it to be authentic. And so he brought along his mother's abaya, which is a full-length black tent dress, really. And then he wrapped a black veil around my head. Sort of, I couldn't hear, I couldn't see peripherally. It was very odd. Very confronting. Mm. And then when we actually walked into the restaurant, I had to put a veil up over in front of my face and try to get up the stairs with this long dress and this veil. And then at dinner, I could loosen the veil, but I wasn't allowed to take it off. And that was a really interesting experience to be on the other side of a debate that's going on now about the abaya. And I have, you know, my own impressions about that. Mm. Now, I personally found it very physically confronting to wear.
So in all this, 75 dates later, how do you feel about the original premise that you set out to test? And how do you feel about men?
I have come away liking men more than I did before I went away. I was a little bit gun shy. I was a little bit, you know, shaken up.
And you loved men.
I've always liked men. I've always enjoyed men. I just haven't necessarily had much success in, you know, getting married and all of that sort of stuff. But I'm probably a bit too wild for most men. But I came back thinking, you know what? Men are just as vulnerable and uncertain as women, and maybe even more so because they've got a lot of social expectations on them. And I found that they were really happy to have someone just listening to them. I don't think a lot of these men really had wives that listened anymore or had girlfriends that listened or that people really cared about how they felt about things. So I dug deep and found out what made these men tick. And you know what? At the end of the day, they're really nice, most of them, apart from the one in Monaco and the one in...
And yourself? How do you feel about yourself after all this?
I came back feeling really good about myself, you know. I was feeling a little lacking in confidence before I went away, but I think I learnt that I've got something to offer people. I'm a good conversationalist. I think I'm a really... What came out of this... I'm a glass half full person. I look for the good in people, and if you look for the good in people, they generally, you know, present well and give back. So I feel really good about myself now.
Well, I think you're quite courageous, and I think the men that you met were very generous, is the feeling that we got as we were reading the book. So congratulations.
Thank you so much. And the men, I'd like to say I'm really thrilled that so many men agreed to meet me and to tell me their story, because, you know, and it's a book to celebrate men and to laugh at them a little bit too, but mostly to celebrate them.
As we should all do, laugh about ourselves at the best of times.
Absolutely.
It's a funny old enterprise being a human. Bambi Smyth, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Natasha.
Bambi's book, Men on the Menu, 75 Delicious Affairs, it's probably an overstatement, around the world, and it's published by the 5 Mile Press. Details on the Life Matters website. Lots of comments coming in response to our high-density living discussion and also penalty rates. Catherine on Facebook, retail and hospitality require workers to be at their beck and call, working at times which are not family-friendly. A little monetary compensation isn't a hard ask for large, aggressive corporations running pubs, bottle shops and retail outlets. I do feel for the smaller business owners who are working the times of penalty rates or stay closed to defray costs. That's one comment. And Susan writes in response to high density living, it can be difficult. I personally dislike high density housing as I have pets, and rarely can we have pets in high density housing. But on the other hand, I would happily live in the city if I could have my pets.
And Peter writes, high density is a rubbish way to live. I've lived in houses in suburbs all over Australia. However, due to a divorce, I had to sell the family home and rent. Only one townhouse was a good experience. And she describes her life in an apartment block right now, which is sounding quite tough. Thank you very much, Peter, for sharing your story. But Michael Cathcart is coming up. The man talking Booker.
Talking of lovely men, Michael Cathcart's coming up.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. Thanks for helping.
I'm just helping with your segue.
Yeah. Brilliant job. The man Booker. You know, I haven't actually caught up with who won.
It's Richard Flanagan.
I can't believe I missed that today.
Isn't that fantastic?
That is just unreal, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm thrilled. Oh, so he's a lovely
man.
Out of
six authors, he's won the gong.
He's the guy.
So well deserved.
Yeah, so we're going to talk to him tomorrow. We're going to replay an interview we made 12 months ago with him tomorrow. But today we're at the Melbourne Festival and we're looking at a fantastic Aboriginal play called Knee Bone Sticking Out. The word on this is that it's one of the great Aboriginal plays ever.
Oh, curious. Thanks, Michael. That's Books and Arts Daily. Man Booker Prize winner Richard Flanagan up next. And coming up to the news now. It's 10 a.m.